Welcome everyone to episode 2 of series 2 of the LSHTM Viral Podcast. I'm Carl Byrne and I'm joined with my co-hosts, Amy.
Hello everyone, I'm Amy Thomas.
And Naomi.
Hi Carl, hi everybody.
How are you both doing?
Yeah, I'm pretty good today.
So I'm looking forward to today's episode because food systems is something I've kind of always been interested in, and it's really awesome to hear that the center researchers are working on it.
Now, before we go any further, we should tell the listeners what this episode is about. In this episode, I interviewed Professor Alan Dangour, who's the director for LSHTM's newest center, the Center of Climate Change and Planetary Health, and also Pauline Schielbeek, who's an assistant professor in nutrition and environmental epidemiology, also working in the center. And in the conversation I had with them, we talked about food chains and nutrition and global health and how that ties in with climate change and planetary health.
The thing I quite like about what they're doing is they're focusing on the nutrition aspect, whereas a lot of the time, I think the focus has been on volume. So how do you actually produce enough crops and where you need to or have been animal products as well. But they're really thinking also about in a way that keeps people healthy, which of course is the focus of planetary health. So how do you get your vitamins, your minerals, all that in food crops and in diets while at the same time meeting the needs of 10 billion people? I don't know how many we have now.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be 9 billion by the middle of the century. So we're at 7.8 billion at the moment,
which is a lot of people. That?
There's someone going around with a little clicker. Yeah, they go around just 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
But then you got to have somebody with another clicker as well for when people pass away. So one in, yeah. One out.
Yeah, it's like bouncers on the nightclub door.
I wonder if anybody knows how many people are on Earth at any given time.
I think that they know within a small margin of error because you've got census reports and things like that, and then you can sort of...
Is that really accurate, though? Do you think there's... Yeah. I mean, there's probably lots of people living that are not on the census.
I want to know the exact number.
Well, how accurate do you really need to be whenever there is, you know, 7,800,000,000-ish people?
But then I wonder if there's double counting, too, because, I'm Canadian. I live in the UK. I think I'm technically counted in both countries, according to the last censuses. So...
Interesting.
So we've got a few people like you who are double counted, and then we've got people who may not be counted at all. So it probably balances
out. Maybe it evens
out. Yeah. You know, what's 100 million plus or minus between friends?
Well, the bigger question is how do we feed them all? And how do we feed them all so everyone stays healthy?
Mm. Well, one of the things that came up in this conversation, I don't want to spoil too much, but at the minute, there's definitely enough food to feed the entire world. That might change as time goes on and climate change affects where land can be grown. But the bigger problem is healthy food, as you've already mentioned, and it's different between the global north and the global south.
And I guess the other part of this is, looking at what impact the food system itself has on emissions and on the planet. So as well as making sure that we've got enough food to feed people and it's good, nutritious food, we have to make sure that the food that we're supplying doesn't have like adverse impacts on the environment, or we can adapt to that or mitigate as much as possible. So it's quite interesting, this topic, because there's two sides to it. It's like how can we feed people with healthy food, but then also not damage the planet at the same time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting trends in different cultural approaches and income-based approaches to diet as well. We had this discussion recently that it's cow burps are responsible for most of the methane emissions. I thought it was cow farts, but apparently I'm wrong.
I always thought it was cow farts as well.
It really comes down to the fact that cow farts are funnier than cow burps, and that's why it gets reported on cow farts, yeah.
Although cow burp is pretty... I've never seen a cow burp. I've hung out with a few cows. Is it sort of a soft, like, release from the throat? What do they do? I've never heard about it.
Oh, you haven't been around cows long enough.
I have you heard a cow burp?
I have.
What
you
does
have.
It sound like? Can you do it for us?
Well, it may not have been a very, very healthy cow, but it was kind of a... I can't believe I've just impersonated a burping cow.
I think our listeners will very much appreciate that on their morning.
Well, on that note, I think we should move on to the conversation with Alan and Pauline before I embarrass myself anymore. Hi, Alan and Pauline. Thanks very much for talking with me today. Now, Alan, you're the director of LSHTM's newest centre, the Centre of Climate Change and Planetary Health. Could you tell us the aims of the centre and the reasons why it was set up?
The centre was set up because we realised that there was a huge amount of research underway at the school on the links between climate change and public health. And we wanted to bring all of that research together so that the researchers could work together and innovate and generate new ideas, and also to showcase the work that the school is doing. And the purpose is to generate evidence-based solutions for planetary health. So very much not just describing the problems that we hear about all the time, but actually to identify the solutions that are needed and guide national and international policy.
And planetary health obviously covers a very wide range of things. Today, though, I'd like to talk a little bit about nutritional health and food systems and how they relate to climate change. Now, on the surface, these may seem like three very different areas, but how do you bring them together?
They are very, very closely linked. And I think they are, you know, this really lies at the crux of the health of the planet. We know that the food we eat is a major determinant of individual and public health around the world. And it's clear now that the majority, a large proportion of the ill health around the world is caused by either insufficient food or poor quality diets. And that evidence is now incredibly clear. But that food that we're eating, those diets we're eating, are produced by a food system, the broader system of agriculture and marketing and processing of foods. The food system produces the foods and the diets that we eat. And that food system is dependent upon a healthy environment. If the environment is not healthy, and as we're seeing, it's increasingly degraded, and it's much harder in many parts of the world to produce the food we need. And as that happens, so the food system struggles to produce the foods, and then the diets of populations are changing. So this link between the diets of people and the environment is incredibly strong. And at the same time, the diets that people eat have an impact on the environment. And so there's a negative loop that happens. If we're eating foods that have a large environmental footprint, so the environment is challenged and suffers. And so, you know, food is absolutely central to the health of people and the health of the planet.
Pauline, where does the problem lie with the current systems we have?
Well, the current food system in the world is both not really delivering on nutritional health and is also causing quite a burden for the environment. First of all, there are approximately 2 billion adults in the world that are overweight, more than 600 million obese, and also a very large number of people living with micronutrient deficiencies. The most common micronutrient deficiencies in the world are iron deficiency or anemia or zinc deficiency, and also vitamin A deficiency. But at the same time, approximately 20 to 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions are caused by the food system, and they withdraw approximately 70% of all fresh water in the world. There are other problems. For example, that large monocultures, so large fields with very similar crops, for example, have an impact on biodiversity. So there's a lot of things that are wrong with the food system at the moment. But this also offers an opportunity because lots of different changes that we can make in the food system will have both positive impacts on health and on the environment.
There is a very big debate about how we grow more food on less land and how we protect nature. And that is very clearly part of the discussions. Recent research has demonstrated that biodiversity loss cannot be mitigated entirely by wide-scale conservation activities and must include changing the way we use land, especially in agriculture.
So with a world population on target to reach 9 billion by the middle of the century, how can we ensure sustainable food systems that are also healthy?
But this is critical, and we now have sufficient evidence to move this debate forward. You know, we eat diets which are provided to us by a very dominant food system here in the global north, and those dominant food industries provide us with diets which are very rich in nutrients, and they contain large amounts of animal source foods, and generally speaking, they're very damaging to the environment and are also bad for our health. And what's clear is that we can change those diets. We can make choices about what we eat, and we can choose to select foods that have a lower environmental footprint, whether that means that we choose diets with less animal source food content or diets that contain foods that have travelled less far or used less water in their production. So different agricultural processes, but also our choices to change the foods we eat. And that's very much the case in rich countries. Poorer countries, of course, it's a different question, because often those diets are of insufficient quality already, and there are real concerns to improve the quality and a real need to improve the quality of those diets. And in those settings, what we need to do is to ensure that those diets contain the nutrients and the diversity of foods that's required. But as they change, and as those countries become richer and the diets of those countries change, we need to help them transition so that they don't just eat what we're eating here in the northern countries, in the richer parts of the world, high intensity diets with large environmental footprints, but they transition sustainably into diets which are healthy, culturally appropriate, but also have a low environmental footprint.
Yeah, it is interesting to see that actually we do produce more than enough food. And most probably with the agricultural advancements and the new ways that we are exploring to produce food, we will probably be able to produce more than enough food for those 9 billion. But the problem lies very much in the accessibility of foods and the inequalities in what foods are available and affordable to people all around the world. Hence, there is a lot of work to do in that area. I wanted to point out also that international trade complicates the accessibility and the availability question in food systems quite a bit, but also offers an opportunity. So looking at where we are importing from and to, and whether these trade flows are sustainable, and also from an ethical perspective, perhaps not from countries that have very severe water shortage problem, is something that we really should look into to make the global food system more sustainable.
And it seems that although we all live on this one planet, the problems that people are facing are very different depending on the region. So how do you go about looking at each of these areas? Do you look at them in groups of countries, or is it global north versus global south?
So a lot of research has been completed in the past decade tackling this question. And naturally, these problems were first looked at from a global perspective to get a kind of a ballpark figure of what sort of changes are needed. But we've really come to the realization that we have to look at the national or even sub-national level to see what changes we can make on the ground, and also to work with governments to see what sort of strategic changes can be made in the national food systems to make them more healthy and more sustainable. And this is everything to do with the way how people go about consuming their food, what cultural differences are there, what's different ways of food production, import and export, and processing, etc. There are. So in Center on Climate Change and Planetary Health, we very much take a national approach. And we look, for example, at food systems in the UK, in West Africa, in Southern Africa, and also in India. And to give you an example of what people could do in the UK, we recently completed a study where we looked at the national dietary guidelines in the UK and looked at healthiness and sustainability of diets of people in the UK that were adhering better to those Eat Well guides versus people that were not adhering so well, so had diets that were quite different from what the national dietary recommendations, the Eat Well guide, were recommending. And then we see that those that were actually following these guidelines had healthier and more sustainable diets. So that's an important starting point. Try and get people to adhere to the Eat Well guide in the UK, and this probably is quite similar in other countries around the world. We already improved the healthiness of our diets and reduced the environmental impacts of our diets. To make our food system even more sustainable, I think we should go beyond that, trying to first get everyone to have a diet that more or less adheres to the Eat Well guide is a very good first step in the UK.
I would add that in other settings, there is also a lot of research underway about increasing the diversity of crops that are grown. So at the moment, we have a predominance of the major staples that's wheat and rice and maize are being grown and consumed around the world. But there are many underutilized crops that have the real potential to be grown at scale. They typically have a lower environmental footprint. They're typically more able to cope in difficult conditions, environmental conditions, drier conditions or hotter conditions. And there's much research, including work we're doing here at the school with partners in South Africa, to look at the potential for those crops which are traditionally grown but are largely neglected by the large food industry, to be an alternative source of diets in different settings.
And with these crops, is there a reason why they're being ignored? Has it got to do with the yield of them or the taste of them?
The tradition is that these crops are eaten. And what is happening as food systems are being taken over by large food industries, of course, these foods are no longer popular with the food industry because they grow less well, or the yields are lower, or whatever. They're less saleable, and people also want to transition to these other crops like wheat, which have different properties. So, you know, I think there's a variety of reasons. But, you know, what we need to do is we need to look for those solutions. And things like these underutilized crops are a really good example of the sorts of solutions that are out there. But they require investment and research and quite a lot of engagement with people who understand, you know, who've been growing these crops for millennia. And see them, you know, and there's an opportunity to maintain them. And, you know, that's in South Africa, that's West Africa, we know that's the case. And we do work in India as well with colleagues who you know, there's a huge variety of crops that are grown in India among smaller communities that have real potential to be the crops of the future, really.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how you can make these food systems robust as time goes on. But first of all, what are the main problems that you foresee in the future that are going to lead to a problem with food chains?
Well, there are a number of problems in a food system that are worrying. One is the environmental footprint that I talked about earlier is a large contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions and also of water use in the world. And what might be most worrying is that these trends seem to increase rather than decrease. So we see that food imports from countries that are climate vulnerable are increasing. And so that puts more of a burden on food production areas that are actually perhaps not so suitable or might become increasingly unsuitable to provide the world with certain foods or crops. So that is something to really start looking into. Where is food produced? How is food produced? How can we make this more sustainable? Because currently the trends are not going the right way to make the global food system more sustainable.
If I can turn to you now, Alan, do you think governments are doing enough to tackle these problems?
I would say that we are aware, increasingly aware, of the impact of projected climate change, projected environmental change on the yields of crops around the world. And we know that temperatures are projected to increase substantially over the next 50 to 100 years. By 2100, we're going to be 3 degrees hotter than we are now, and less predictable rainfall. And there's now very good models to identify the impact that it's going to have on global yields of crops. And that's a considerable concern. So we know that cereal production is projected to decline by between 15 and 20% around the world, especially in the global south. We know also from work that we've done here at TELUS-HGM that vegetables, legumes, fruits, nuts and seeds, the yields of all of those important food groups is going to decline under projected environmental change. So that is a major issue. We know that's happening. Governments are aware that it's happening, and it will have dramatic impacts on the ability of governments to feed their populations healthily. I'm increasingly concerned that governments are very slow to act. They are not acting sufficiently strongly to tackle this issue. We are aware that there will be declines in the ability of many countries around the world to feed their populations because of climate change, and yet we do not see any action at the national or the global scale to tackle that issue.
So what do you think is needed to ensure that the countries in the global south will have access to the same robust food systems that the global north may be able to develop?
We need to make it clear that climate change is a health emergency, and at the very centre of that emergency is food. If people do not have food and do not have access to healthy diets, there will be massive problems. There will be population displacement, there will be mass migration. I don't want to sound a scaremonger, but we've seen it already. We've seen 10 years ago where there were spikes in the prices of food, sudden spikes in the prices of food. There were riots in 20 or 30 countries around the world because people could not afford to buy basic foods, basic commodities like bread. We know that's going to happen. And now we're seeing this happening slowly, this disaster unfolding slowly. And governments are not acting. They can't carry on. Climate change is a health emergency. We need to put food at the center of that debate because food is central to our existence on this planet.
I would add that there are a number of no-regret options, and one of them is, especially for the global north, is a transformational reduction in the amount of animal source foods that we are eating and go towards predominantly plant-based foods for most of the countries in the global north. This is also to reduce the impact that climate change has, and that is mostly or more predominantly in countries in the global south. So I think we have a responsibility there as well to make sure that our food systems and our diets are more sustainable. And one of the questions that we are interested to answer within our work in the centre is also to look at, if people are willing to change their diets, how do they go about it? What facilitates a diet, a more traditional, quite animal source food heavy diet, to become a more predominantly plant-based diet? What sort of foods or food environments, so for example, how products are laid out in the supermarket, or what other ways there are to, for example, order meal boxes or fruits and vegetables on specific offers. And so we're studying that to see what drives people to make those transformational changes in their diets and how we can use that to also convince others to follow.
In recent years, there's been quite a lot of press around foods like the Impossible Burger, which a plant-based burger that tries to mimic the taste and texture of meat, or also vat-grown meat. Do you think these are viable alternatives, or are they just gimmicks?
What we've seen is an explosion in the response from the food industry to this question. How do we get people to change their diets? What alternative foods are there with a lower environmental footprint? And there are many alternatives out there now, and I'm aware of many more coming through. And not only alternatives to animal source foods, but alternative ways of growing crops. So, for example, there's now many cities in Europe, for example, have seen a huge increase in the growth of vegetables indoors using vertical agriculture. So that's in warehouses. They're growing lettuces and other green vegetables in cities now. And that's a huge change that's happened recently. But at the same time, there are these new technologies that are coming through, and they are really interesting because they offer the opportunity for solutions. What we know less about is actually their environmental footprint. We know less about their health benefits, and we know less about, you know, various other things. But they are options, and we've got to keep this door open. We've got to keep the door open to alternatives, to options, to solutions for the crisis we're in.
And even although we are not fully aware yet of the health and environmental impacts of certain animal source food alternatives, such as the one that you were mentioning, hopefully it at least starts the debate and makes people think about their diets and look for different possibilities to make their diets more healthy and more sustainable, and to facilitate that kind of transition from their current diets to diets that potentially are more healthy and more sustainable for them.
What changes have to be made both at the local level, the national level, and the global level in order to avert what sounds like an oncoming crisis?
We need action at multiple levels. We need people to engage with this issue. There's a lot going on in the world at the moment, and I hate to pile more things onto people's to-do list, but engaging with food and engaging, thinking about where it comes from, thinking about the environmental cost of that food, thinking about how often they need to eat certain foods, thinking about what their diets need to look like, that is something we need to really stimulate much more. And I know there's a lot of debate about this now in many countries, but we need to increase our ambition in that space. So that's at the individual level. There is many things institutions can do. So why don't all institutions, that's hospitals, that's prison services, that's universities and other major employers, why aren't the foods they're offering their employees and their clients environmentally sustainable? And then, of course, you know, governments have a massive role to play. And I think that the governments really need to take a much stronger line on this and recognize that they have to protect the health of their people, but they also have a role to play in protecting the health of the planet. We cannot just carry on as we are, taking from the environment without worrying about the wider impacts.
I think engagement with the younger generation is really crucial here as well. And I've seen some wonderful examples of great engagement with younger people, discussing with them the problems, making them aware of the relationship between climate change, food systems and nutritional health. And it really ranges from vegetarian cooking classes, discussions, singing songs, but also, and not only in the UK, but we have done some work in West Africa where we talk about water shortage and what sort of foods require less and hence how that could be built in diets of people in West Africa. And you see interesting ideas coming from the children themselves. And I think this will be crucial because they will be the future leaders and they will have to deal with our food systems, their sustainability and healthiness in the decades to come.
I would also add, we need to work much more closely with our partners across the food industry. So whether that's our partners who are engaged in the agriculture sector, so defining the seeds that are grown, defining the crops that are grown, on how they're grown. Whether it's our partners in the processing industry, defining what foods are processed and in what ways. Whether it's our partners in the catering and supplies and other industries which provide foods and meals. What is in those foods? What is in those meals that are being provided? And of course, the innovations that we need from the private sector to identify new ways of producing foods with a lower environmental footprint, which will slowly, but they will change what we eat and how we eat. And I think that, you know, that partnership needs to happen much more strongly.
Alan, you mentioned how institutions can help with the food on offer. I know in LSHTM, before we started working from home, you had introduced with the catering team the planetary picks on the menu. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We had a fantastic option in our refectory, which was devised by the refectory manager, which was a series of meal options every day, which had substantially lower than average environmental footprints. So a range of fantastically delicious meals, either hot meals or pre-boxed, which had a lower footprint. And there was enormous take-up by the staff and students at LSHTM who wanted to, you know, do their part. But they weren't doing anyone a favour. These were absolutely delicious meals, and they became a very popular part of the options in the refectory at LSHTM.
And having tried a lot of the meals off the Planetary Picks menu, I completely agree with you that these healthy, nutritious, sustainable meals are not necessarily boring, but they can be vibrant, tasty and delicious. Some critics of this might say that we're just talking doom and gloom here and that the problems with food have been around or have been complained about for years, going all the way back to Thomas Malthus in the late 18th century. Again, in the 1960s, there was the problem of food shortages and Norman Borlaug came up with the Green Revolution. Have these just been sticky plasters put over the problem, or do they have a point that humanity has always come up with a solution in the nick of time and will be fine in the end?
I think food systems and our diets and the way how we eat has massively transformed and continues to transform in all countries in the world, much more substantially perhaps than it have done over the past centuries. The way how we go about our food sometimes looks like we've kind of lost the plot a little bit, with animal feed grown in Argentina to be shipped to animals that are raised in the US, to be shipped to China where they are processed, to be shipped to the country where they are consumed. And this is something quite unprecedented. This is not something that has happened before. And I think there are certain planetary boundaries, so kind of the safe space within we can operate and we can live on this planet in a sustainable way. And the food system that we are currently experiencing is really pushing and actually even exceeding those boundaries. And so we need to rethink that. We need to rethink how we ended up in a system where the mileage of food items, the way how we consume them, the enormous amount of ultra-processed foods that we are eating is actually really unsustainable and also unhealthy for us. So I think we have come to a point where transformational change is needed as soon as possible to make sure that we can sustain, and we can make sure that the 9 billion people that we are expecting in the decades to come will have access to sustainable and healthy foods.
I would add that not even 200 years ago, there was no idea that we would be where we are now. And where we are now is going to be quite different from where we are in 2050. It could indeed be very gloomy, but we have solutions and we have got to have the political will to make this, to find solutions, because the alternatives are pretty grim. And what we are faced with now is this double impact of both population growth to 9 billion, as well as significant environmental change by 2050, which will make it harder to grow food in many parts of the world. And those are the parts of the world where population growth will be the greatest. So we now have the data. We now have the information. We now have a great capacity to look into the future and think, what are we going to do? Can we allow this to happen, or do we have to act as a society, as people, as a global community to identify solutions? And we all have a role to play, and the sooner we start really tackling this issue, the better.
Thank you both for those really interesting answers. You've both highlighted during this conversation that there's no one-size-fits-all solution, and that we have to take a concerted effort involving governments, institutions and industry. But is there anything individuals can do to help?
I think one thing that might be quite universal is be critical about what you eat. And of course, that means something completely different for someone in the UK than it might be for someone living in a food insecure country with very uncertain supply of food. Looking what you're eating, where it's coming from, how it is produced, and whether there are any healthier, more sustainable alternatives that still fit within your budget that you've allocated for food purchase. For example, that would be something that would really help. And it looks like we're pinpointing now the problem on the consumer. I think Alan already mentioned the food industry, so better labeling so that people have this information to hand, that they know exactly where everything is. But also perhaps legislation, the legislation that has been passed through for unhealthy foods, so that you can't have the buy one, get one free deals on those sort of snacks. I think it might be important to have a look at that as well for unsustainable foods in supermarkets and the way how they are promoted to us and the way supermarkets lay them out, for example.
We have now more data and more evidence about the health and environmental impacts of foods and diets than ever before. That information needs to be broadcast, whether it's through schools, whether it's at universities, whether it's through institutions, whether it's in governments, needs to be broadcast. Everybody needs to know about it. And that is partly our role, but there's partly roles for the industry and other paid people to take that forward. But that information is there. People can act on that information, but we also need to help them by providing alternatives that are easy, that are tasty, that can become part of their everyday life. And we're seeing that. We're seeing younger people especially really transitioning away from traditional Western diets to diets which have a much lower environmental impact, and they're really taking the lead here. But we need to do much more.
Pauline touched on this earlier, but I'd like to ask you, Alan, how can we ensure that, as we have to feed more and more people, that things like monocultures don't completely take over and we lose biodiversity in the world?
There are always trade-offs in decisions on what to grow, where to grow, how much to grow, and in what way. And again, I return to the essential nature of data, that we have increasing amounts of data that allow us now to analyse those trade-offs and make decisions about, where do we want to grow what foods, where is it sensible to grow wheat versus palm oil, where can we get the greatest productivity? And I think those are decisions that now need to come onto the table. In the past, it's always been, here's a piece of land, let's grow something. And those decisions now have to be, here's a piece of land, what could that land be used for? Would it be best for agriculture? What form of agriculture? And if not, how do we ensure that nature has a chance on that piece of land? We have to protect the nature of this planet. And that is exactly why the links between food systems and planetary health are so strong.
So do you have any thoughts having listened to that?
I got hot about halfway through, and I just felt Alan's anger. I really did. And I was quite scared, but I'm glad that towards the end that there was a discussion around, you know, what can we hope for the future and innovations and like talking about potential new food solutions that people are working on is quite reassuring. But yeah, it was
the future is dark, but there is hope.
Yeah. But I suppose, you know, I guess it makes sense because, you know, there needs to be action taken, and without like being, you know, too alarmist, we have to say that there is a problem that we need to work at this time.
Yeah. I think it was good as well that they really hammered home the point that there's things that individuals can do, but it's not individuals' fault. This has to come from institutions, from government on a much higher level.
Well, and so, the trend is that the higher income a country is, the more they move to a meat-based diet. But then there's a trend starting where a lot of cultures are now shifting towards it's more appropriate to have a vegetarian diet. It's more appropriate to have some cases of vegan diet, but that's expensive. It's not necessarily cheap. It's not necessarily time efficient for people to, you know, source out all these local vegetables and then go home and cook them and find the time to do all that. I guess the issue is bigger. It's socioeconomic as well. How do people have time to prepare healthy foods and find them and afford them in a world that is dominated by processed meat-based foods?
And also, some of the vegan products are quite mass-produced and they're quite processed and not necessarily that healthy, even though they're marketed as vegan. So there is kind of a marketing aspect which needs to be considered as well. You know, we can't say that all, you know, going completely having a vegan diet is necessarily healthy, or, you know, we need to be sort of on top of making sure that we still get all the nutrients that we need, which is quite tough, really.
And there's products like palm oil, which has obviously become sort of a big talking point in damage it does to the environment. But we also have to think about, what's the alternative? If you change to another product, is that going to do even more harm? Because it really comes down to sort of the sheer amount of these products being produced to feed the world.
Yeah. And so this is really interesting because I'll talk to my friend down under in Australia about this next week, where he works with a company where they're looking at this. How do you make a meat alternative, so a plant-based food for mass distribution that is also healthy and has all the nutrients and minerals and all the good stuff, and limit the impact on the environment at the same time? I mean, there's no doubt that no matter what food system we have, feeding that many people is going to have an impact on the planet, but it's about mitigating that and limiting the impact as much as we can.
And I think that's a great place to end today's podcast. A huge thanks to my guests, Alan Dangour and Pauline Schielbeek, for such a thought-provoking conversation. Amy, Naomi and I will be back next week with another episode. And in the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with comments about previous episodes or questions you'd like to see us answer in future episodes, you can email us at comms@lshtm.ac.uk. That's comms@lshtm.ac.uk. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this podcast, leave us a review and share it with your friends, family and colleagues. Until next time, I've been Carl Byrne, and you've been listening to LSHTM Viral.